Okay, we are back, and our next guest has created, I believe, created, written, produced, and did the research for the documentary called Decades of Deception, which I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched a really great deal of it. But because there's so much information and I had to keep pausing it and rewinding it so many times to absorb it all, it ended up taking like 4 hours to watch it. So we have Ryan Dawson from Japan, actually. It's what time? It's 9 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday.
Yeah, it's 9 a.m. tomorrow. You could think of it.
Yeah, how does the future feel like? I mean, is things getting better or worse?
I think things are getting better. If you look at the Iranian peace talks and things are starting to turn a corner. But I'm glad you had a hard time watching Decades of Deception, because that's exactly what I wanted. I packed it with information, and I was hoping people would watch it and rewatch it and rewatch it, because it's kind of a macro version timeline of horrible things government and intelligence industries have done. I call them industries. They call them themselves agencies, but I call them industries because that's what they are. Over a 60-year period, starting from the Korea War on up to 2010, and it's just endless.
It's like drinking a shot of wheatgrass juice. It's like packed
Well, I mean,
full of garbage.
anybody that's got a problem with conspiracies needs to watch this film, because what people don't realize, that conspiracy is a dirty word, because there are a lot of charlatans out there with some off-the-wall things. But every covert operation that has ever been carried out by any intelligence agency is, by definition, a conspiracy, because you've got a bunch of people getting together and lying about something that's otherwise illegal, and usually murdering a bunch of people all in secret.
But I mean, now things are not even so secret. I mean, it's almost pretty much like out in, it's getting so much more out in the open. Like a
Yeah,
lot.
and their excuses are getting more and more sad. You can really see that it's because of the internet. I mean, if you could contrast, let's say, the first Gulf War to the second Gulf War, which were not that far apart, but you look at there were worldwide protests before the second war in Iraq, before the war even started, and you're having 500,000 people in New York City, you had a million people in London, just all over the world protesting the war. Then you look at the first Gulf War, which was also based on deception and lies. I mean, that was a Hilton Knowlton, Tom Lantos created war, and there were just yellow ribbons everywhere, and there weren't any protests at all. And the reason they could get away with it was because the internet wasn't around then, and it was for the second time around, for the second war. And so the information could get out, the media monopoly could be broken, and that was 2003. So now, I mean, the internet's much larger. Even during the second Gulf War, there wasn't a Facebook yet. There wasn't even a YouTube yet. A lot of the social network sites didn't exist. A lot of radio shows like this probably didn't exist. And so we have a definite advantage now. So the future is looking better for Team Justice.
What about the NSA?
Yeah, but at least we know about it. I mean, that again, like, we've known since 2006 that they were doing that. I mean, it was reported in newspapers and things. I think the naive thing was that a lot of people wrongly assumed that when Bush left office, that was the end of that, and Obama wasn't going to continue it. And of course, as with everything, Obama just made it worse and bigger. That's what he did with all of Bush's policies. But unfortunately, people tend to vote for people and support people based on psychological gratification. So all somebody has to do is kind of sloganeer some vague thing like hope or change or yes, we can or whatever, like Obama did, and they'll just fill in the blank with whatever is psychologically gratifying. If they want him to be anti-war, he will be in their mind, even though he isn't actually. I mean, this is a guy who, as a senator, put this co-sponsored to put the sanctions on Iran, the bill for that. He voted to keep the Patriot Act 3 times. He voted to finance the war in Iraq 3 times. He voted for every act of violence possible. So when he became president, nobody should have been shocked that he's going to up the drone policy, triple the size of the war in Afghanistan. He tried to stay in Iraq as long as possible. We were there until December of 2011, which was the agreement that the Iraqis had made themselves with the Bush administration of when to pull out, and Obama tried every excuse in the world to try and stay. But people just, they vote against people rather than for someone. They say, well, he's got a D next to his name, so he must be different than the Republicans, and they don't look at the policies or the record of the individuals they're voting for. So like a lot of people have a lot to learn.
Yeah, love is blind kind of thing.
Well, it's like they needed it. They needed change. And so they were willing to believe the first guy to get up on the hill and say it.
They wanted
it to be true.
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, I bring this topic up a lot because I hear it a lot. You know, oh, be positive, you know. So it's kind of, you know, people want to just look at the positive. They don't want to look at the, you know, the not so nice things. And so, you know, to question, a person or to look at that, you know, to really take a look at who they are before you just kind of, you know, open up to them and let them in. I mean, look at the TSA. I mean, they don't let us get away with anything. I mean, they're feeling us up left and right. So why the heck should we just, you know, with open arms, let people in, you know, just because
there's one thing the TSA does let us get away with, and that's bringing weapons onto planes. Because in all the blind tests and all the testing they've done on the TSA, if you really want to, people can still sneak things onto a plane. So that security hasn't been upped at all. All they've done is wasted a lot of money and made flight travel, you know, more expensive, and you're kind of guilty until proven innocent.
And humiliating. I just wanted to, on the previous guest, Roger Landry, he's got this post that reads, U.S. generals now take action to watch Obama. It says General Vallely said the U.S. faces a battle that is unknown to generations of Americans, and that the fate of the nation is now in our hands to enforce the Constitution and severely limit the federal government and its out-of-control spending. I wasn't sure if I just kind of saw that just a little bit ago, and I thought I would, you know, maybe mention it in case you weren't aware. I mean,
certainly have out of control spending, but where have they been? I mean, over 51% of our discretionary taxes are spent on the military itself. I mean, there's a $1 trillion sinkhole on all of our military escapades, which are completely unnecessary. Bombing people in Yemen and Pakistan, financing Al-Qaeda in Syria, giving the Israelis, which is an absolute fascist state, which is ethnically cleansing their neighbors, billions of dollars every year, giving billions of dollars to Egypt, which they won't call a coup, even though it was a coup, because if you label it as that, you're legally not allowed to give them aid. They're financing Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who's butchered millions of Africans in the Congo. They're supporting Al-Shabaab and Saudi Arabia. I mean, if all this foreign aid, it's not foreign aid. Mostly it's predatory loans, or it's forgiven loans, aka grants, to absolute despots. I mean, the Saudis are getting so much money from our military industrial complex, and these are people who won't even allow women to drive cars. And the Israelis get more foreign aid than anybody in the world, and they're literally bulldozing down houses for the chosen race of God, self-proclaimed. I mean, it's Nazi-like stuff. And so until we cut that money, I'm all against the bailouts and everything too, of course, but. Yeah. Stealing from people is not nearly as bad as stealing and murdering people, and we've got to stop both.
So let me ask you then about terrorism. You hear that word, you know, everything is terrorist, terrorist, terrorist. So what is your take on
communist, or drug dealer, drug dealer, drug dealer? They always have some boogeyman. You know, and the best way to fight terrorism would be to stop engaging in it ourselves.
Exactly. Like the movie Dirty Wars kind of addressed that, you're just creating, you know, and again, they always have a label that really doesn't fit what they're calling. Right, they're calling someone a terrorist when all that person really is having sort of a normal reaction to their family being blown up.
What would we do? You know, what would our country do in the same situation? And the same thing when they used to say communists, and I'm not pro-communist or anything. I think it's a screwed up economic system. Like in my film, Decades of Deception, I mentioned Operation Washtub for just one of the examples. What they did is they went and planted weapons, Soviet weapons, in Nicaragua as a pretext to invade Guatemala. So they're saying that they went and discovered weapons that they put there themselves and said, aha, you're in league with the communists, when they knew that wasn't true because it was their own weapons they put there. They just wanted a pretext.
The value of the dollar has gone down so much, and maybe people have to work like so much more to keep up, which makes them that much less able to kind of keep up on what's going on, which in my mind that should alert you right there, to something being wrong, like that. People don't have the time to be looking into this stuff, and so they just take like Fox News's word for it, or Obama's word for it. And
sure, really, I mean, Fox News and MSNBC are just the left and right hand of the state. If you look at the media conglomerates that own the mass media, they all go back to the Pentagon, all the parent companies. It's just one big zaibatsu, as we'd say in Japanese. It's a network of state authorized talking points. They literally have talking points. That's why you'll see the same uniform catchphrases often in the same order on supposedly different channels. And it's just a joke. And the dollar's gone down a lot more than people know.
Right.
Peter Schiff has talked about this a lot too. If you look at the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and just the cost of everyday living and everyday goods are going up a lot. But what they always do is they compare the dollar to other currencies, but the other currencies have also been going down. We've been seeing austerity worldwide where the standard of living is dropping dramatically. But then they use that relative to each other rather than just your past self. You can say, what did the groceries cost last year compared to this year? Very simple things. I mean, people know from their own receipts how much gas is going up, food's going up, etc. They cannot buy as much as they used to be able to buy, not only for foreign goods, but even domestically. It's just not worth it because of all this quantitative easing, influx of trillions of dollars into the system, which started at the top and never trickles down.
And because everything is made in China, too, so it's... it's all like, fairly low in cost. And, that's why people are buying things from China, because it's
cheaper. Low in cost to manufacture, but that doesn't mean these big companies pass on that savings to the consumer.
Yeah.
And China basically has virtually slave labor and no environmental laws. Not everything made in China is made by slaves, but there are a lot of sweatshops and factories with suicide nets and people in complete work or starve conditions in China. It's a horrible communist country. It is not anything to model after or get excited about how they're developing or anything, because you cannot judge a nation by its richest people. You have to judge them by their poorest. And China has 200 million people working for $2 a day.
I mean, could you imagine? It's like, let's judge a country by how much a few people abuse the rest.
But that's what they do. That, like, even in the U.S., they judge the economy by the stock market. But the stock market is only an indicator of, are the richest people in the world a little richer today than they were yesterday?
The poor people are just not even part of the equation. I mean, when it's a clear indication. That's what's like so bizarre. It's like they're dismissing the clear indication that the country is not working as an indication that it is working. I mean,
exactly. Like, are we consolidating wealth at the top? Hooray. I mean, what's the mean level of income? What's the unemployment rate? What's the CPI? What, you ought to get those numbers and you can figure out how the standard American, Canadian, or whatever you're judging is living. But instead, they say, is Warren Buffett making more money now than he was yesterday? I mean, that's the judgment of, well, you know, if our if our top stocks are doing well, if our biggest corporations are doing well, then everyone must be. And usually they have no relation to each other at all.
So that's what I mean. So there has to be some kind of like Stockholm syndrome that people are suffering from, you know, in order to think that, I don't know, by Warren Buffett getting richer, that's doing you any good. You know what
and
I mean?
By the way, Warren Buffett was selling the bailouts as this wonderful thing, but he had millions, tens of millions of dollars invested in the financial institutions who he needed to have a bailout. And this mortgage-backed security fraud was just pure theft. I mean, they actually paid rating agencies to lie and give AAA ratings to these CDOs, which are just big packages of subprime mortgages, basically. And they sold them off as if they were as good as government bonds. It was total deception. It's totally illegal. And nobody went to jail. They got paid.
I mean, so what, like... I mean, you're a fairly young person. You're from the U.S. And so
yeah.
What made you go to Japan?
Bush got reelected.
Oh, so then you've been in Japan for a while.
Well, I've been here, and I went back to the U.S. From 2008 to 2010, and then the dollar dropped to about 75 yen, so I came back to Japan.
So. Okay, like, just give a little bit of your history, like, you know, how did you get into all of this stuff? You're obviously, you know, pretty, you know.
When I was a teenager, actually. I started when I was like 10 years old. I remember arguing about why we need a line item veto to cut pork out of bills. I remember getting all into the debates with Dukakis and Bush seniors, and when I was a real, like, I kind of gave up on it all until I was a teenager. And when the internet came around, I had a site mainly for Native American issues. That was my passion, and because I feel like that nobody deserved a voice more. And then I just kept, as I learned more, and I kept adding more issues and talking about things that I'd ran all the time about, I made a little web page on AOL Hometown. And this is important for people to know, because when I was doing this activism, and I probably had 12 people reading it or whatever, I had no hope of winning or ever being on television or any things I've done now. It's just I was fighting injustice, not because I thought I could win. I fight injustice because it's injustice. And I had no idea that how big the internet was going to explode and all what was going to happen in the future. I was just doing it because it was the right thing to do. And I guess after September 11th, my site really took off because I ended up making a film about 9/11. But I just converted everything into making an anti-war site, and I was very active against the second Iraq War. And from there, some people started helping me, and I changed my sights around, and then I started getting on radio programs. I predicted the 7/7 bombings in London. So when I did that, a lot of people had me on their radio shows and saying, "How'd you know that? What are you doing?" And then I started making films, and it came along. So when YouTube came around, it used to only be 10 minutes, you know, videos, and they censor everything on there. But it's gotten better. And I used to put things on Google Video when they had that back in the day. And then MySpace, and then Facebook, and so on. And so as social media has grown, so have I. And the more I know that I can make impact, now that I know that I was on Russia Today 2 days ago, talking about the P5+1 peace talks in Geneva, and I can routinely go on the news now, and I can really make an impact now. But that all started with like a dozen people on a really lame homepage on America Online, you know. But that's how it began. And I left for Japan in 2005, in August or September, around there. It was shortly after the 7/7 bombings. I decided to get out of the U.S. I was getting threatening phone calls and things.
Oh, really? Yeah. I guess you probably can't talk about that. But how did you end up...
But yeah, I mean, I just decided to leave. I wanted to leave anyway. I wanted to travel and see, you know, other countries anyway for just completely non-political reasons. But
did you pick Japan? Like, why Japan?
Because Japan is so different and I knew so little about it. You know, that was my real, I just wanted to see a completely different culture. I was just very interested in Japan since I was probably 6 years old.
And they don't have the same level of, slavery and pollution that they
Japan
have
has
in China.
90%, no, it's a 90% middle class, and people talk about how the Great Recession for 20 years that Japan has had. But I would say quit judging countries by their stock market. I think this decentralization of wealth has been a good thing. You talk to people who lived in Japan through all that. And yeah, in the 80s, Japan used to have 50% all the money in the world. I mean, they were kicking butt in the standards that are used to judge nations. But what they were doing,
Unbelievable.
yeah, what they were doing wasn't the nicest of things. And having the bubble crash, and you know, a lot of people lost a lot of money. But you're thinking, maybe countries shouldn't be built with a few billionaires on the top and everyone else struggling. Is, you know, now Japan is in 90% middle class, the longest life expectancy, like the top five in healthcare, I think number three in education, like just they whatever measuring stick, whatever you want to use, they're winning, except stock market. Now, right now, they have a bad prime minister, Shinzo Abe, is not, but still, relative to Barack Obama or Netanyahu or some of the crazies that are out there, Japan's still doing fine.
So you said you don't judge a country by its stock market. I mean, right, just like an individual doesn't maybe want to be judged by the way that they look, or maybe a guy doesn't want to be judged by how much money he has or the kind of car he drives. I
Sure,
mean,
yeah.
it makes sense to look at it a little bit more, deeper qualities rather than just looking at a country for its stock market.
Yeah, or like how strong its military is or something. The US has a powerful military, but you know, what other countries, even with remotely the fraction of the market that the US has, have people dying from because they're going to debt for their health care? And people, that is the largest, the number one reason people are in debt, even more than housing prices or anything, is medical bills. And people are literally dying by avoiding the hospital or losing all their savings trying to save a loved one who has cancer or something because of the US for-profit system in healthcare, which is protected by government regulations. The Medicare, for example, they can't negotiate prices with Big Pharma to get the prices of drugs down, because the government has protective regulations preventing them from negotiating. And that's the main problem with the healthcare system in the US is the total cost of procedures and drugs.
So what do you think the American people need to do?
They need Medicare for all or some kind of single payer system. There are a lot of systems out there that work that could be copied, but it's not going to happen so long as until we can have the separation of business and state. And we have a lot of low information voters who keep perpetuating the system because they're voting on wedge issues like gay marriage and things that, in the long run, really are social issues and not that important compared to war and health care and debt and bailouts and the, you know, much larger issues. Because
So
you're not going to have any social programs once we go broke. Whatever it is you like, we're not going to have money for any of it soon.
why do you think the US is over in the Middle East? Like the real reasons that they're over there?
The Israeli lobby, no, just no doubt. There is no benefit. There was no benefit for the U.S. to invade Iraq. There is no benefit for the U.S. to put a target on Iran, and there's no reason to foster factional fighting in Syria. It's an Israeli plan, but they've purchased our Congress because they are one of the only countries that has an unregistered foreign agent that can openly bribe Congress, who can personally profit from these misadventures in the military. Because they're not, it's not their money they're losing. They're giving away other people's money. They're giving away your money. They're giving away my money. Well, not giving away my money anymore. I don't pay taxes in the U.S. anymore. But see, Israelis, I mean, it's the old plan from their own policy papers. I mean, you can look at the Iraq War. It wasn't about oil, or the petrodollar. That's one of my pet peeves. I mean, the euro didn't even exist when the propaganda started about Saddam Hussein and trying to have regime change in Iraq. And all they did was recycle lies that they'd been saying in the 90s that caught on in the 2000s after 9/11. They had enough political clout to get away with it. But all that junk about the anthrax and the mobile weapons labs and all the WMDs and things, these are things that were reiterated that had been said before by Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and all these Israeli partisans, you know, dual citizens with Israel who worked in the Pentagon, Louis Libby, Douglas Feith, who even created a special office inside the Pentagon called the Office of Special Plans, whose sole purpose was to generate a war in Iraq for Israeli interests. And Paul Wolfowitz is, you know, they had Feith and Zell, his sister is a settler in Haifa. I mean, these guys are crazy. And George Bush Sr. used to call them the crazies in the basement. That's pretty bad. Bush Sr. is calling someone crazy. You got to be really crazy.
Seven countries in 5 years, I think it is,
the plan. Wesley Clark had that out, and that's the plan. But they've had this since the 80s when they drove Iran and Iraq into a war for 8 years. They fought each other. That's when Saddam was on our team, so to speak. But you see this constantly, and that's in the film too. I like to point out how much the CIA outsources to organized crime. And it doesn't matter if you want to call them cartels like Fast and Furious with the Mexican drug cartels, or you want to call them warlords. As in Afghanistan, like with the Mujahideen, and then there's MEK, there's Jandallah, there's al-Nusra, there's al-Shabaab, there's of course, al-Qaeda itself have all been financed by the CIA, and you can go all the way back into the 50s with Operation Ajax in Iran. You've got, or the Contras, maybe people remember in the 80s, and then, of course, the La Cosa Nostra and the actual mafia. To assassinate people, for coup d'etats, for rent-a-crowds. This has been an ongoing tactic.
It's all out, and it's pretty out in the open. I mean, it doesn't take much if someone really wanted to find out. I mean, it's pretty,
Contra, I mean, the CIA's plane, they crashed a plane full of drugs. What happened, Ali North was on trial before the world and talked about plausible deniability and wasn't even ashamed of it. There's someone that should have been in jail for life, and I believe he ran for president after that. And lost.
Then they throw poor Bradley Manning in jail. I mean, yeah, but anyway, yeah. Bill
they
Steele
put Mordecai Vanunu in jail, and they put Mordecai Vanunu is the original whistleblower, and you had Russ Tice and Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning. I mean, for Bradley Manning to be in jail, when these bastards at Goldman Sachs have robbed people of everything,
it's you get thrown in jail, the more. Well, you embarrass them is really what it comes down to.
That's right.
But, so Bill Still is going to join us. We'll just take a really, a quick break. And then we'll talk about, how you kind of met or got involved with Bill Still.
Okay.
And so we'll take a quick break. Okay, we are back for the last segment of Organic News here on Awake Radio, and we have Ryan Dawson still with us, the creator of the documentary Decades of Deception, and we also have Bill Still joining us. I think this might be your third time with us, Bill, but you're the one, Bill, who recommended Ryan for me to have him on. So how do you guys know each other, and in what capacity do you?
Well, I've been on his show two or three times, and the first two times I was on, it came right in the middle of a flurry of a bunch of interviews, and so I kind of lost track of who was who. But I remembered the voice, that this was a really sharp guy, and I've subsequently recounted a story that he told me, I think, during the first interview that even though he lives in Japan, everybody that he hangs out with his age, really the only thing they want to talk about is monetary reform. And I've retold that story at least a dozen times.
And so, yeah, you've been on his show a couple of times, you said? Ryan, you got a show?
Yeah, he was. He actually was on last week, too. I've got a show, ANC Report. It's the Anti-Neocon Report. And I also did a show. I work for Sybil Edmonds, who is an FBI whistleblower. You know her. that was Boiling Frog's post, and he was on that show too. And I do like to talk about monetary reform because that is a big issue, and actually Bill is the one who opened my eyes to that a long time ago. And so that's why everybody probably demands his knowledge on that subject. But we talk about other things as well.
It seems like what's happening is that, you know, the people that are pulling all the strings are turning money into a mirror image of themselves, you know, something that has absolutely no value.
They seem to be, and Bill and I talked about this, and I agree with his opinion, there seems to be a sort of concerted effort globally to inflate simultaneously for a lot of central banks.
Well, it's the only way they can cover up what they're doing. And so if just the Fed continued with quantitative easing all by itself, it would become apparent as the currency spreads continued to diverge. And so the only way they can really do it is to all inflate simultaneously and hope that that holds off the evil day. But, you know, this this complementary currency thing in the form of cryptocurrencies, it just really caught my imagination here in the last week. I suddenly figured out what was going on, and that's these cryptocurrencies are just a form of a complementary currency. It's a way for we the people to get around this debt-based system, and right. those who figure it out earlier are going to fare much better as time goes on.
It's like a monetary lifeboat, like an an inflatable monetary life raft.
Oh yeah, lifeboat. I thought you said light bulb, and I couldn't figure that out. Yeah, life raft. Yeah, there's a Noah's Ark out there, and I believe that's in the form of this new currency called Quark, which just started in July, and I would urge everybody to go on and look at my latest report. I don't get any money out of it. This is just a lifeboat that these Quark developers have given through my channel to people who listen to me, because it's a really good deal. And, you know, you all could put $10 or $100 into it and really secure your financial future just with that much.
So then you think that this Quark coin is better than quantitative easing?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's just it. It actually works in inverse proportion to that. The first attempt was really Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has some serious flaws, but it's still, you know, 1,000 times better than what we've got. And Bitcoin now is just off the races. I believe it was nearing $1,000 a Bitcoin at this point, and it started out, you know, just for tenths of a penny per Bitcoin. So Quark is during that in that same curve right now, and it's just a way out of the system, and you know, onto a system where money is much more plentiful, and it just depends on, you know, doing a few simple steps on your computer, and all of a sudden the light bulb comes on.
Well, I want to thank you for sending me some of those quarks. I appreciate that. You said that that, you know, due to you, it doubled or tripled in value.
Well, no, there was just a story that I just put up on my latest Steel Report tonight, just half an hour ago. There was a story in something called Crypto Life, which is the major blog on cryptocurrencies, and their head reporter just did a story on it and said, why is it that Quark has increased 2,000% in the last 4 days, despite the fact that it's not yet on the Chinese currency markets? And
because it was on the Bill Steele report,
right? That's what he attributed it to, and that's wow, that's amazing. I didn't know, you know, I had that much ability to influence people, but I guess it has.
I do,
and you have much bigger numbers than what they show, as I explained before. YouTube is not the most honest with that stuff.
Yeah.
I have the article that you sent me, and it's, you know, it says, now why is Bill interested in Quark of all currencies? And it seems to have, like, it makes 3 points. The first, it says, because he understands economics and money systems, Two, he, like many others, has a concern around the centralization issues of Bitcoin. And three, he feels that Bitcoin went from virtually unknown to mined with ASICs, specialized hardware. So I explained the distribution method of the Quark system. He likes the idea of a grassroots-type cryptocurrency that cannot be cornered by a very few people. This cannot be done with Quark, as I explained, as the distribution was effectively done by computers. The price has been depressed, and now anyone can have Quark.
Yeah, if you wanted some problems, if you wanted some problems with Bitcoin, you should have on Carl Dininger. We actually talked about it. He was on my show. We were talking about thorium, but off air, we talked about Bitcoin for a while, and I wish I recorded it because that could have been a show all by itself. But you should have him on. Or I'll have him on in the near future, and he can explain very well the problems with Bitcoin, but it's different for Quarks.
Well, I guess, you know, because Bitcoin, you know, it was the first. I mean, it's only normal that it's, you know, that the first trial run is going to need a bit of tweaks. And so, you know, other people can learn from Bitcoin's mistakes and just improve, you know, like the Quark coin has done.
Yeah, well, these guys were the developers, very specifically told me about it first, because they could have just gone straight to the Chinese exchanges and the thing would have exploded. It's going to explode no matter what. Nothing can hold it back at this point. I'm just trying to let people who are followers of me, who like me, in on it and try to convince them, yeah, this is a good thing. Give it a try, you know, and it could go up another 1,000% or 10,000%. I mean, I'm no investment expert. I mean, I could be completely wrong, but it just looks awfully good to me. It's going to follow Bitcoin's path, and Bitcoin's at $800 per Bitcoin right now, whereas Quark is still down at a penny per Quark. So it's still got a lot of room to run.
Yep. Yeah,
$10 is not going to break the bank. If you want to invest $10, even if you lost it all, it's not going to ruin you or anything. But if it does go up in value exponentially like that, you'll be glad you did it.
I bought last year at a Liberty Forum in New Hampshire, the Bitcoin, like a couple of Bitcoin guys were there. And, you know, this was when I was just hearing about this stuff. And they had like this little like makeshift ATM machine type thing. Like it was maybe the size of a small like stereo speaker, and you know I was, you know, like a little bit skeptical, so I was like, okay, well, let me just try it. I had about $40 to spare in my pocket, so I stuck two $20 bills into this little ATM machine, and you take your cell phone, you know, you go to the website and you wave your cell phone over one of those like square code things, and it transfers and changes it to Bitcoin, and so now my Bitcoins are over $1,000. So just about like a year ago.
Yeah, that's it's, and Quark is going to probably go to the same place. It's just going to go there a lot more quickly, because now people realize that, yeah, this can really happen. It's not just a fluke. These things can run. I just got the coolest comment on my Facebook page that I want to read to you. Just take a second. Okay. This is from an artist friend of mine. He says, I'm currently reading the book called For Us, The Living by Robert Heinlein. It's short and pretty amazing. He describes a work based in 2086 that demolished fractional reserve banking, implemented a public banking system which uses its funds to create and distribute something akin to an unconditional basic income. It was written in 1938, but only published in 2003. It's an amazing read. Could be possibly be a great foundation for a new documentary.
And say the name of the book again, For Us?
For Us, The Living by Robert Heinlein.
The Living. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to live.
I wonder why it took so long to publish.
I don't know. Found out about it literally half an hour ago, and just as you all called on Skype, I just ordered it off of Amazon. So that's really all I know. But I mean, humanity is just being completely choked to death by this debt money system. It's clear that people are eventually going to find a way around this. These guys are rich and fat and slow, and we can beat them.
Yeah. All they know how to do is the same thing over and over and over again anyway. Like, they are so not adaptable to change. So even the slightest shift in the system can just send these people, like, you know, crashing down. Like, they wouldn't know what to do.
I'll tell you a term I can't stand is when people refer to them as elite or the elite. There's nothing elite or superior about them. There's nothing genius about counterfeiting money. You don't have to be smarter or better than anybody to basically just print money or digitize it and steal it.
And they rule by threats of violence. And, you know, people understand that, and they're naturally going to push against it. And now this is hurting so many people that there's becoming a very broad-based consensus, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. I guarantee you there are groups of people just like us talking over this exact same issue in every nation on this planet right now at this very second. This is becoming a real force worldwide, and I just don't see how they're going to be able to hold it together that much longer.
So let me just ask you, like, I mean, you don't think that, like, hopefully the American people haven't gotten too complacent and they're not going to be able or be prepared to make this transition to, like, a Bitcoin or a Core coin or something? You know, like, I mean, like, your old-fashioned kind of people that are not very technical, and they'll be like, oh, my God, what the hell is a quark Bitcoin or something?
Well, yeah, there's going to be a lot of people like that, and I was one of those until a week ago. So, I mean, I freely admit my ignorance and my error, the error of my way. And now I understand that this is just another complementary currency. It's just one that, in order to trade on the internet, had to have extraordinary security features. And the first one, you know, was, it could have been implemented better. And so now people sincerely interested in doing the right thing have created a better one. There are over 100 other types of cryptocurrencies out there. And it doesn't matter if you kill one. Another one is going to come forth because it's a natural expression of humankind's trying to escape from this vulture debt money system.
People do the learning curve on technology. If you look at, there was even resistance to cell phones for a lot of people that I don't want that, and I'm not going to text, I'm not going to push the letters, I hate that, you know, and oh, I'm not going to do a touch screen. And but they're doing it now. Pretty much everyone has a cell phone and uses it, including, I guess, the stereotype of the elderly or whatever that aren't tech savvy. They are. My grandmother's 85, and she uses her. She can build a website. She can do it all. She's learned how to do it. People will adapt to the times. Nobody likes to do it in the beginning, but we all end up doing it.
Right. Would you guys say that this Bitcoin or Quark coin is kind of like a digital greenback? Would that be something? Maybe?
No, because a greenback was debt-free, government-issued money. Why I say it's a good complementary currency. It's and I wouldn't want a transnational currency at all. I think that's way too consolidated. I think you still need your sovereign, debt-free national money systems. But there is just oodles of room for complementary currencies. And, you know, right now our attempts at complementary currency before these digital cryptocurrencies were just really a kind of pathetic. I mean, I know several guys who have just spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to make them happen and pouring their lives into them, and they're still very, very ineffective. This is a serious challenge to the debt money system.
Do you think they're scared over at the Fed?
Well, I think they are scared, but Bernanke just came out last week, as well as the FBI, saying, hey, there's nothing we can do about it. And there is nothing, because there's 120 or 117 of them out there. They're transnational. They can't do anything to regulate them outside of the borders of the United States anyway. I mean, there's just nothing they can do other than try to control it. And, of course, the theory is that was something, one of the factors behind behind the creation of Bitcoin. And maybe it is, maybe not. It's not. I'm not even going to argue the point right now. I just know one that's better, that's more deconsolidated, and can only be mined by PCs. It cannot even be mined by the big specialized hardware, which only J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs is able to afford.
Exactly. Right, like in Canada, they actually limit the hardware. So I know people in Canada who were asking Americans to covertly mail them the stuff they would need to mine the Bitcoins because they can't even order it. So, I mean, one of the many flaws with that is, you know, if you got a better mining system, you're going to get more coins. I mean, there's a lot of problems with that. But this is a different system. You can't lump them all. You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are other cryptocurrencies that are functional and do what the Bitcoin was hyped to do without the flaws that Bitcoin has.
And the people controlling our debt currency now, like, there's no way that they could just, like, buy up, you know, like, all the Bitcoin.
No, absolutely. Not at least not with Quark, just because it's so distributed. It's already in the hands of thousands of people, and if somebody tried to go around and buy them all up from each individual person, well, you know, somebody wouldn't sell because the price would work inversely to the consolidation of it. And so even if they had all the money in the world, they still couldn't buy all the quarks in the world.
See, that is a really excellent security measure there. You know that.
Yeah, I think quarks are going to actually, I think they're going to dominate. I think they're going to eventually become more expensive than bitcoins. I don't know that for sure, but I just feel real good about it, or else I wouldn't be behind it.
And how is Jekyll Island doing, Bill?
Well, it's selling very slowly. I didn't like the original edit, and I just finished a different edit of it. So we've got it down to 88 minutes, and this was at the suggestion of the network that's going to play it if we could get it down below 90 minutes. And so I spent about 3 weeks doing it, and so now it's done, and it's in L.A., and we'll see what happens.
Can you say who the network is?
I could say who the network. No, I probably couldn't say. I shouldn't do that.
Okay.
It's not ABC, CBS, or NBC. It's one of the smaller ones, but still very significant for a monetary reform film.
Is there a time frame as to when it would be aired?
No, but you'll be first to know.
Oh, great. That's all I need to know. So what are you going to be doing for Thanksgiving?
Going up into the mountains of North Carolina and having dinner with family.
Cool. Do you eat turkey?
Oh, of course. How about you?
I'm not going to have any turkey.
We actually don't have turkey in Japan unless you go to Costco, which is amazing. Oh. Yeah. It's so we'll be having chickens, maybe.
Yeah, I can't.
That's something I miss the most food-wise from the States is turkey. You don't have turkey in Japan.
You're not missing anything. The turkeys are grateful. So, okay, any last... So, Bill, where can people find you? What's your website?
You can't find me at all except on my YouTube's comments, because my website has been completely obliterated this last week. I don't know what's going on, but you get a page expired. So just forget about my website. Let's talk about rockets.
I linked to yours, and it might have got... Sometimes you get too much traffic, it can crash too. But hopefully Bill and I might be working together in the future, because... the Still reports that he has on YouTube are excellent, and I'm going to kind of mirror what he's doing anyway on my site to increase traffic. And I really encourage that. I think there's some others who are coming on board as well who I just think are great journalists or have great information, and we're going to be networking in the very near future. But my site is ancreport.com, and I have podcasts up there. Usually every other day, sometimes several in a day, as well as like press interviews, usually for foreign outlets, Russia Today, Press TV, things like that, articles, etc. So ancreport.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, you guys have been great. And we'll keep in touch and have you back on in the future. And good luck with with everything you do, and enjoy Japan.
Hey, well, thanks for having us, and Bill, thanks for recommending me.
Hey, you're the greatest. I'll tell you, between you and Deniger, I couldn't ask for more.
Awesome. Well, we're all going to be together soon, so yeah. All right. Well, thanks.
Have a good night, everybody.
Bye.